elemental philosophy. Judaism denies that history is predestined, that human life is predetermined. Rather, life is what we make it out to be, and history is the sum of human achievements and of human failings. The bloodshed of Vietnam need not have happened. We need not have been involved in Vietnam in the first place. There is no traditional American sphere of influence in Southeast Asia. The perimeter of our national defense does not begin or rest or end in that part of the world. Until 1954, there was not a single American soldier in Southeast Asia. We could then have accepted the hard, worked-out decisions of Geneva, which made largely for the neutralization of Indochina and spoke of a plebiscite within 2 years on the possibility of reunification of North and South Vietnam. We need not have made Vietnam a cardinal element in our national strategy. And even assuming that we accepted in good faith and full understanding Secretary Dulles's determination, his dream, if you will, to turn South Vietnam into the very, very model of a very, very modern Asian democracy, we could have limited our aid to economic support and not sent in military technicians and guns and tanks and planes. It's well to remember that in 1954, South Vietnam was not threatened by external aggression of any kind, that our intelligence did not find the first North Vietnamese soldier in South Vietnam until late in 1960 and early in 1961. And once it became clear that Diem used the language of democracy, social change, land reform, public welfare, as a pretense to guile Washington into giving him all manner of aid, and that he was, in fact, simply a more modern version of the traditional Oriental Mandarin, the feudal tyrant who rules by fiat, by law, by his will, who stamps out all opposition, who will not permit democracy and freedom in his land. We could have called back our technicians. We could have ceased all military aid. And we could have curtailed, if not stopped, our economic aid. American foreign policy did not rest on the support of one Asian general who had never been elected by any kind of vote to the leadership of his people. I said as much to you a decade ago. The sermon which I called America and World Revolution. From this pulpit, I tried to detail the sad history of Vietnam. I tried to show how our best laid plans to improve the standard of living, to permit economic and land reform, had gone to naught. We had poured in money which had been grabbed and taken unto itself by a few hands. We had sent money for dams and for farms and for seed, and the money had bought Cadillacs, air conditioning units, and swelled the bank deposits of certain of the coterie of Diem in Switzerland. We looked to Diem to support our policy of containment, that naive policy of drawing the line about the world and saying to the communist world, thus far shalt thou go and no further. And we had sent him guns and planes and tanks, presumably to fight communist insurrection and communist attack with them, when in fact we should have known that he would use these guns and our uniforms and our bullets simply to equip his national police to suppress all dissidents. I spoke to you then of the traditional paramilitary bandit groups which abounded in the South Vietnamese countryside. I reminded you that we were helping to bring about. They're swelling in number by adding to them a stream of political exiles, a stream of young student idealists who had been disillusioned, a stream of people who knew who was the enemy, Saigon, Diem, and who was the support of the enemy, Washington, and our national administration. And I warned then that the small communist coteries, which had always existed in that part of the world as they exist everywhere, were being given all manner of aid and comfort by our actions because they could point out the enemy and the colonial power which supported the enemy, and they could make good on the one promise which the dissidents, the revolutionaries, the Viet Cong needed above all else. They could procure arms and bring in supplies and make possible revolution. And I suggested then that the United States would do well to review its policy of military assistance and military aid to nations which had no other credentials than the credentials of anti-communism. For anti-communism in Asia translates to mean an opposition to the demands and the rights of the emerging mass, the traditional 90% of the Asian poor who have been held down and oppressed and persecuted by their own racially their own overlords. And I warn them, quote, to support the tyrants of yesteryear is to invite frustration and to court serious defeat. In the intervening decade, we have tasted, have we not, the bitter lees of that frustration. We have faced and do face the defeat of our policy to create an American toehold in Southeast Asia, to insist that our values are the values by which Southeast Asia must govern itself. Now let's put South Vietnam aside for the moment. One could argue that the events in South Vietnam, given the original mistake, were inevitable. But have we learned a lesson? Are we realigning our strategy and our policy so that there will never again be a Southeast Asia, never again be a war which no one wanted for reasons no one fully understands in a part of the world which is not of crucial interest to the United States? 4 years ago, there were 35,000 American troops in South Vietnam. 10 years ago, the revolution in the countryside was hardly talked about. Today, there are 35,000 American troops in Thailand, and the revolution in the countryside of northeastern provinces is hardly talked about. 6 years ago, we were supporting a military junta, which we said was racially one with that of its own country in Saigon, and we were helping that government to make itself a model, Western-style, technologically advanced democracy. Today, in Thailand, we are supporting with arms and with aid a feudal oligarchy, which claims that it is setting about to make Thailand into the very, very model of a very, very modern Western state. And we face the open opposition of those traditional castes and classes and groups which are outside the camp, denied any rights. And we are again allowed with the bankrupt forces of yesteryear, the forces which suppress labor unions, which censor the press, which deny reform. There were 35,000 American troops in South Vietnam 4 years ago. There are 500,000 today. There are 35,000 American troops in Thailand today. Pray God there will not be 500,000 4 years from now. When it came to time to review the year 1960, at a time when there were only some 1,200, 1,800 American military technicians in South Vietnam, I warned against a policy of military escalation. I said to you, every attempt to settle and to accommodate the issue within the United Nations, if possible, without if necessary, should be attempted before large-scale, helter-skelter military commitments are made by our nation to the present government. commitments which can not only create another Korea, but which can create the Holocaust we all fear. Now, unfortunately, those attempts at accommodation, which I suggested were not rigorously prosecuted, and unfortunately, those helter-skelter military commitments were made and made again. And today, 13,000 and some American young men have lost their lives in Southeast Asia. 250,000 men, women, and children of both camps, armed and civilian, have been killed. I'm told that this benighted land looks today as if it were a blasted lunar landscape. More bombs have fallen on South Vietnam than on the entire European continent during the Second World War. Napalm, devastation, defoliation, carnage and destruction beyond credence and beyond belief. And today we not only face a policy which seems incapable of achieving its limited objectives in Vietnam, but we are courting the very danger that all of us fear. That this nation will become embroiled in a land war in Asia against the most populous nation in the world, against the largest nation in that continent. We admit today to regular overflights of the Chinese mainland. We have begun drum beating in Washington a kind of holy crusade against what the Vice President called last week that militant, aggressive communism of the Asian variety, which has its headquarters in Peking. We are close to that Holocaustal war, that war which can only end in defeat for all, so close that its specter haunts us. And yet, strangely, we have yet to find the first Chinese soldier in the Vietnamese war. Strange to behold and strange to accept as a simple truth that the North Vietnamese have not yet permitted the Chinese to enter their land and to support them in this war in which they are David and we are Goliath. From the very beginning, we blinded ourselves to the facts of Vietnamese nationalism, to their millennial fear of the great Chinese power north of their borders. From the very beginning, we refused to accept the simple fact that one of the reasons Ho Chi Minh accepted the 1954 Geneva Declaration was the fact that it placed men who were supervisors and observers on his northern border and precluded Chinese infiltration of North Vietnam. And refusing, as we did, to allow Vietnamese nationalism to take its own course, saying that we were in Asia to preclude the advance of China, we have succeeded really in bringing about, or almost bringing about, the very thing that we say we fear. In 1950, General MacArthur warned us against a land war in Asia. He said we could not win it. Our strength lay in guns and in planes and technological advance and not in manpower. And such a war can be fought only by men, and we have found that to be true in Southeast Asia. In 1954, the Joint Chiefs of Staff overruled the State Department's suggestion that we flag military support to the French at Bien Den Phu, because they said that this was the first step in a progression and an escalation of military activity that could lead to a land war in Southeast Asia, and we ought never to be fighting on the land in that jungle, in that swamp, in that quagmire. And yet here we are today, knee-deep in the mud. We've lost almost a division of men, a great deal of prestige, a great deal of our confidence, and we are helping to hasten that day which we say we fear, in which we will have to take on the armies, the naked manpower of the most populous nation in the world. It's not a pretty picture. We have made one mistake after another. But what I deny, and the reason I cite all of this past history, is not to take any pride in being a political analyst or political prophet. You don't have to be a clairvoyant to know that if you back the forces of reaction, you are tied to the past. That if you back the feudal dictator, you cannot be in tune with the new spirit of the new age. That if we are friends of the oligarchs, we are not friends of the revolutionaries. That if we insist on a policy of naive anti-communism, we cannot see clearly the facts of the realities of policy in Southeast Asia. I cite this history simply to insist that there have been alternatives all along the line. And that there is an alternative now, an alternative to more bombs and more planes and more death and more napalm and more coffins and more destruction. And that alternative is not escalation, that feckless military policy of bombing more sites, of possibly of invading North Vietnam, of overflying China, of search and kill, and search and kill again. That policy is a policy of the escalation of negotiation, of admitting the possibility of peace and acting on that admission. Now, Washington has agreed that negotiations are necessary, that there is no alternative to going it alone, to following out this tragedy to its ultimate devastating conclusion. For 2.5 years, the president has talked about negotiations, but he has said his hands are tied because of Ho Chi Minh's adamant refusal to negotiate. Now, Ho has been curt in his dismissal of our proffers, and I, for one, consider his dismissals of our offers to be foolish and stupid. Considering the American temper, I believe that Mr. Minh could win at the conference table all that he can legitimately seek, and that is the neutralization of Southeast Asia. That is the possibility of the unification of these two countries. That is the elimination of an American military presence from the area. I can accept his dismissal and explain it only on the grounds that he is determined to make the proud American eagle eat humble crow. But having said this, I remain confirmed in the belief that Washington has another alternative besides taking the steps, the military steps, one by one, which lead to the greater danger. We have the alternative of admitting that the Viet Cong control large areas of Southeast Asia, of trying to get the Saigon government of Viet Cong to arrange local agreements. We have the alternative of ceasing the bombing of North Vietnam now, not a month from now when the weather forces it, now when it would be an act of to show the world that we are interested in peace, and not a month from now when it is simply a military convenience designed to, as everyone will know, to silence the critics at home. And we can, without cost to ourselves of a great order, cease the bombing, because as the Secretary of Defense has himself said, the bombing cannot, has not, and will not completely interdict the supply by North Vietnam of its regulars in the field. We have the alternative of using the great technological power that we have, our knowledge, to play the peace game instead of the war game, to escalate the possibility of negotiations, not to escalate the possibility of military confrontation, to arrange local negotiations in the field between Saigon and the Viet Cong, to arrange international negotiations between Washington and Hanoi, either directly or through a third party, or through a reconvening of the Geneva Conference, or through the United Nations, or through any other such source. But the possibilities exist. They have not yet begun to be explored. It's not a question of either or. Either Ho accepts our demands and our offers as they are made, or we fight on. There's a large gray area in between. And we have not begun to parse this area down, to look at it carefully, to put it under a microscope, to see if we are indeed listening to every opportunity and taking advantage of every offer. The Indian ambassador to the United Nations said some very important things 3 weeks ago. He said, in effect, that his government's understanding of Hanoi's position was that it does not prohibit or preclude negotiations. What Hanoi will not accept is a negotiation to which it must come as a tired, almost defeated nation, where it will be handed what? A Korean-type settlement, which will say, the 17th parallel remains, you remain north of the parallel, we remain south. The United States did not have a presence south of that parallel before 1954. North Vietnam has fought Goliath to the standstill to preclude that presence, and Ho will not come to the table if he feels that this is the peace that he is being offered. The peace that he can accept, as the Indian ambassador made it clear, was a Laotian-type peace. A peace which speaks not of a permanent Korean division between North and South, but of a temporary division, of a neutralization of the area, of a popular front kind of government in Saigon, which will represent the entire South Vietnamese country, not just those who are our allies, and are finally our withdrawal of all of our forces from that part of the world. Now, this is not an American victory, such a negotiation. It means the burial, the end of Dulles' ambition to create the pro-Western small state, that toehold in South Vietnam. But is the alternative acceptable? Can we continue to accept death and carnage and destruction and the possibility of war with China for the small advantage of having a country in our camp who are our allies in the sense that we support them entirely, financially and militarily, and who certainly would want ultimately only one thing, Yankee, go home. We paid a terrible price for our mistakes in Southeast Asia. To negotiate peace is to pay another price. It's to pay the price of frustration, frustrated ambitions. Surely the opposition party, which now is beginning to talk of peace and of alternatives to Vietnam, would make an issue in the national election of appeasement and of national pride. The hawks would scream. But surely the fallout from South Vietnam is such today that we cannot continue to accept it. It has alienated many of our traditional allies because they cannot see the validity, either in cold-blooded geopolitical terms or morally, of our actions. And they know far better than we that this preoccupation with South Vietnam has precluded our concerns elsewhere in the world. Why were the United States' actions in June vis-a-vis Israel in the Near East so weak and so vacillating? Why could not the United States line up other nations to go with it through the Gulf of Aqaba to show that this was indeed an international waterway? Because the military said to the president, our troops are committed. We cannot fight a second front. We cannot take the chance. And Western Europe knows this quite well. It knows that we have had to pull troops out of NATO. It knows that we have had to weaken our defense and our commitment. It knows that we have papered over this weakening of our commitments, but that it in fact exists. This involvement in Southeast Asia has had a tragic fallout far beyond the coffin which flood into our national cemetery. It has made for inflation at home. It has helped to drive the other America deeper into its poverty. More is being made, but the more can buy less. It has forced the government to cut back many of its ambitious programs for that one legitimate war, the war on poverty. The government brings in demonstration projects to the Congress now, not projects which will really help, but projects will simply bring in studies. And Congress cuts these in half and in a third. The poor are poorer. They're more desperate in their plight. The voice of revolutionary militancy rises in the land and becomes the voice that says we will force the cities to a standstill. We will paralyze your communities. The war is portrayed as a racial war, white bodies against yellow bodies, white bombs against yellow huts. And the voice of Negro militancy makes much of this racial element. And there is open writing in some of our magazines of Negro troop mutiny. And this war has alienated some of the most sensitive and some of the best of our youth. During the Second World War, 1 in 1,000 young men applied for conscientious objection status. I'm told that the ratio now is 1 in 300. And that this ratio is itself false, because it does not take in the hundreds upon thousands of young people who are remaining at their studies or finding other convenient ways of getting around the draft laws, determined never to serve their country in a war whose validity they do not accept, never to risk their lives for a policy which they cannot tolerate. We have driven some into open rebellion. They march on our government. They vilify our president. They have taken themselves out of society. And far more are determined to find some other alternative than that of a naive kind of patriotism. This alienation of our youth is a tragic cost to pay for a war which we cannot win and in which we ought not to have been. Our youth are alienated. The colored in our cities are alienated. Most of us feel puzzled, bemused by the inability of our government to take itself in hand, to conquer this need to save face, find practical solutions to a practical problem. We find ourselves growingly incredulous of our government. There is this credibility gap about which so much of it has been written. We cannot forget that in 1965 we were promised the men would be home by Christmas. We cannot forget that we were told once we were in this war to preserve a little democracy fighting against subversion, fighting for its freedom, that it became patently obvious to us that South Vietnam was not a democracy fighting for its freedom. We were told we were in this war because we had commitments, and the nature of these commitments were never made clear to us. And now we are told we are in this war to contain Asian communism, China. The rules of the game, the explanations have been changed on us time and again. We like the government to be honest with us. And we like, by our decision and by our vote, to be able to express our attitudes towards governmental policy. And this, too, has been denied us. Wherever we turn, wherever we look, Vietnam has exacted a terrible, terrible price from the American people. We hope to organize our financial resources, our intellectual resources, to fight the battle of our cities. We've had to put this aside, to put it in mothballs, to shelve it for the moment. We thought to organize a 20-year war against poverty, ultimately to destroy this scourge, this blight from our land. And that, too, has been shelved. We thought to find ways of turning the hearts of the parents to the children, and the children to the parents, of creating a good society, not simply an affluent and abundant society. And instead, we have pulled the generations further and further apart. We thought to teach them of democracy, but they find that they are in a country where they must simply accept and abide and do as they are ordered, that before they can vote, many of them may die in a jungle which they cannot even locate on their map. The game was not worth a candle. The mistakes have been many. And the solution, as I have said often from this pulpit, is withdrawal, the negotiation. Every step which we take towards greater escalation makes ultimately that withdrawal more difficult. Every step of escalation makes our commitment, underscores our commitment, and makes it more firm. Every life we lose is a life we have to explain. And how does one explain lives which seem unnecessarily lost? Time is now for negotiation, for the bombing pause, for the escalation of negotiation, ultimately for withdrawal. The president said a year ago, when he offered negotiations on his own terms, that once these were completed, he would pull back every single American soldier and every single American Marine from Southeast Asia. Obviously, land forces in that part of the world are not necessary to our national defense. Why then are they there? Why must we keep them there? And how long must we keep them there? How long can this nation suffer being pulled apart by a cause which seems hardly worth it, by a struggle which we cannot fully comprehend, in a war which outrages our sensitivities and confuses our wisdom? Tragedy is not a Hebrew category of thought. Hebrew does not have a native word to express this sense of the inevitability of history. It is not inevitable that we enter a land war against China. It is not inevitable that we send our troops north of the 17th parallel and invade North Vietnam. It is not inevitable that we bomb Hanoi and mine the harbor at Haiphong. It is not inevitable that we pursue the war with greater and greater determination. We may, but it is not inevitable. We may, and in my humble opinion, it would be tragic. There is another alternative: to take ourselves in hand, to admit that strategic mistakes were made, to begin the careful, deliberate, determined examination of the possibilities of escalation, of the escalation of negotiation, to see what arrangements can be made in the Mekong, in the Hill Country, in the northern sector, in this province and in that, between the locals and the locals, between us and the North Vietnamese. There are alternatives. It is not a question of either or. The shadows are long and the day is late and the war is violent. And it will take a great leader and a great nation to be able to take a different path now. I can only hope and pray that 7 years from now I will not review my notes and say, the tragedy has come, the cost is great, but what can I say except it could have been otherwise? Amen.